Hello, it's The Takeaway for Friday, March 31st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. On the one hand, we begin with a very local state story of North Carolina's bathroom fears, intolerance for transgender citizens compelled to use a public restroom corresponding with the sex listed on their birth certificates rather than the gender they identify with. But on the other hand, a conservative legislature in North Carolina with the votes to do whatever it wanted yesterday heard a message from outside the state capitol. Pressure from businesses to boycott the state, pressure from the NBA with a team in Charlotte, and especially pressure from the NCAA showcasing its men's basketball tournament this weekend with North Carolina University in the Final Four. HB 2, the bathroom bill, was repealed on Thursday. New Democratic Governor Roy Cooper backed the new compromise bill and is expected to sign it into law. But it's still being condemned by many in the LGBT community, who say it doesn't go far enough. Deb Butler, Democratic State Representative from North Carolina's 18th District, is one of them. Welcome.
Hi, John.
Now, is this process over, do you think?
You know, it's a good day and a bad day in North Carolina, from my point of view. We did repeal yesterday the most onerous and regressive piece of legislation in the whole country, in my estimation, but we didn't do it in the right way, John. We put a Band-Aid on something that could have been fixed, and I'm disappointed we didn't do it thoroughly and completely.
Now, what are the elements of this compromise that you would describe as still onerous?
Well, we did repeal HB 2, which was attempting to control transgender people in their bathroom facilities. And it's the most preposterous, regressive piece of legislation ever. So we did eradicate that. However, we left in the hands of the General Assembly the ability to control public accommodations, including restrooms, thereby preventing municipalities to control. And we're talking about public restrooms. Now, let me quickly say that I do believe that the General Assembly has learned the hard way that that is a subject best left alone. So I don't think you're going to see a plethora of regulations regarding restrooms. I think we're going to leave the status quo there. But what we should have done was take the opportunity to put a statewide non-discrimination ordinance in place. And, of course, the appetite just wasn't there for that.
And that's what the governor endorsed and wished that the legislature had given him on his desk.
True. And I saw the governor face-to-face moments before we went into session. I am one of two openly gay members of the North Carolina General Assembly, and I made an impassioned plea to him and to my fellow Democrats that this was not the appropriate way to go. And Governor Cooper looked me in the eye in front of the entire caucus and said, "Deb, I hear you, I understand, I feel what is in your heart, and we will get there. We just can't do it right now." And I have to say that I believe the governor. He has been a champion of our community. We just didn't have the votes, and the only path forward for North Carolinians is to vote in 2018 in big numbers.
What we've seen in the United States in certain areas, North Carolina being one of them, is these stacked legislatures because of redistricting and because of very aggressive campaign efforts by the GOP and other conservative groups have created these echo chambers in the Senate and assemblies in many states around the country where they can pass laws and nobody can do anything about it, even if there would be a ballot measure that would be absolutely defeated in that state. It does appear that some sort of outside pressure has overruled this echo chamber in North Carolina, yes or no?
Yes, and thankfully so. We have many, many people to thank for it. We have organizations like HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, Equality North Carolina, the NBA, the NCAA, the ACC, PayPal, Bank of America. You know, these national organizations and business came together to say, you know what, we're not going to participate in this, and we're not coming to North Carolina if you don't fix it. So I'm sorry to say it was not the moral high ground that got this thing done. It was dollars. And so however we got there, I'm happy for that. But this just renews my commitment to doing the Right Thing, which is a statewide non-discrimination ordinance for all North Carolinians.
What's your assessment of what North Carolinians would believe it would have been the monetary value of all the threats of boycotts and the ones that have already been put into place of these various groups that you described if nothing had changed?
Suffice to say, it's hard to quantify when we don't know how many businesses just didn't even take a second look at North Carolina. That is unquantifiable. But the estimate that I saw was $3.6 billion, with a B, dollars. That's a huge number, considering the entire budget of North Carolina for a full year. The entire budget is $22 billion.
Now, is it the case that in this compromise law, that if I'm in a rural community in North Carolina and I want to pass a equal rights for transgender citizens of my, municipality, I'm prevented from doing that?
You are prevented from doing that. And that is a tragedy. So what we have done, we have placed a moratorium until the year 2020, which is way too long, but there's a moratorium until 2020 for that. At that time, cities, towns, and other organizations, other entities would have the ability to address the issue at that time. And it's way too long, but the truth is, you know, we are under a court order. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals mandated that we redraw our gerrymandered voting districts. And we are currently under a stay right now from the Supreme Court on this issue. But we are going to have to redraw our gerrymandered districts soon so that by 2018, the playing field will be leveled. And I'm confident that when we do that, we're going to pick up a handful of Democrats and at least squash the veto-proof majority that currently exists in both the Senate and in the House. The GOP has an absolute stranglehold on us. Fortunately, we have the governor. He can veto, but they can override it.
Is Texas going down the North Carolina road, or are they just blowing smoke over there in Texas?
You know what I thought was just insane, and that is that our lieutenant governor, Dan Forrest, made a trip to Texas to try and encourage them to make this horrible mistake that we have just gotten over. It's insane to me, but I heard that the Republican Texas Speaker of the House said that if we have come to a point in our society and in our culture when we are legislating bathrooms, we have gone too far. And North Carolina should stand as the poster child of what not to do.
Now for the bad news, Deb Butler. I'm wearing a Gonzaga sweatshirt.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to end this call now, John.
So you're North Carolina all the way.
Go Tar Heels, you bet.
Deb Butler is Democratic State Representative from North Carolina's 18th District. Thanks so much, Deb.
Thank you, John.
Another detail not to be overlooked in this transgender discrimination debate appeared in a draft of the 2020 Census, an American Community Survey. In the draft, a question on sexual orientation and gender identity was removed. It would have been the first time the federal questionnaires asked for this information. Removing it 3 years before the census begins indicates a possible looming culture war debate. Earlier this month, two significant federal surveys on older Americans removed questions on sexuality after collecting this data for years. Michael Adams, the CEO of SAGE, Services and Advocacy for GLBT Elders, spoke to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick and says LGBT elders are disproportionately affected by what could amount to a lack of data on their population.
We're looking at the erasure of LGBT people and LGBT elders specifically by the federal government. And we first noticed it after the administration tried to quietly slip it into the Federal Register for comment with no fanfare, no warning. Fortunately, we followed the Federal Register closely, and that's how we discovered it.
Do you have any insight as to why these questions that were being asked regularly are not going to be asked anymore?
Well, frankly, it seems pretty clear to us that the reason they're not going to be asked is because this new administration does not have any interest in understanding and addressing the needs of LGBT elders. It is hard to imagine what other reason there would be to take these questions out, since they were the only questions removed from the survey. It's not as though there was some overhaul of the survey and this was one of many things. The only thing what they did was to erase LGBT elders from the survey. So it's hard to interpret it any other way other than a complete lack of interest in this population.
So, Michael Adams, the entire American population is graying, and therefore LGBT elders right along with them. What are some of the special needs here that you feel are going to be missed if these federal programs aren't asking recipients or Americans anymore if they're part of the community?
Well, it's certainly LGBT elders face the same challenges that other older Americans face and more. And in particular, one of the most significant special difficulties is a very, very high level of social isolation among many LGBT elders. This comes from the fact that most elders from LGBT communities are not parents, and so as they age, do not have adult children to help care for them. They're much more likely to be single and living alone. They're much more likely to be disconnected from their families of origin. So all of that leads to thin support networks and a greater need for services. In addition, LGBT elders are more likely to age in poverty than older Americans in general, and they're more likely to age with serious health conditions. So when you put all of that together, it actually creates a greater need for the kinds of services that come from senior centers and Meals on Wheels and other programs that the federal government has historically funded.
So it was one thing for the federal government to be asking these questions to have a sense of how much of the population has these extra needs that you're describing. But were these federal programs responding in a way that made the questions worth it? I mean, do you feel that if the new administration isn't asking who's part of the LGBT community, that somehow the actual services will wane?
I know that the actual services will wane, because what we have seen is over the years, as LGBT people have been included in these surveys, we have started to see federally funded service programs and elder service programs become more responsive to the needs of LGBT elders. We have seen significant progress in federally supported programs addressing these very acute needs. And so it only is logical to assume that the erasure of LGBT elders from this survey is going to lead to the opposite, because frankly, the erasure delivers a message that they don't matter, that LGBT elders don't matter. If that's the message that the federal government intends to deliver, that is absolutely going to have a damaging effect on the delivery of federally funded services to this community.
Is there recourse here? If it's in the Federal Register, technically there's public comment. Can you stop this?
We certainly are trying to stop it, and we hope to stop it. We're in a public comment period for the next 50-plus days, and we are encouraging people all across this country to submit comments in opposition to this really poorly considered decision. We intend to do everything within our power to stop it.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much.
That's Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick talking to Michael Adams, CEO of SAGE, Services and Advocacy for GLBT Elders. Neither the Census Department nor the Department of Commerce have commented on any changes in text related to sexuality or gender. What does it take to become a police officer in the U.S. these days? Well, according to a Marshall Project investigation, there is a strong set of hiring preferences for U.S. war veterans, and that large numbers of veterans seek to join the pool of new cops, bringing with them, in many cases, some special personnel issues. Simone Weichselbaum is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. She investigated the veteran-to-cop pipeline over an 11-month period for a report that was published this week. William Thomas is a longtime member of the Newark, New Jersey Police Force, started his career in law enforcement in 1985, was deployed to Iraq in 07-08, He is currently a retired sergeant with the Newark PD. William Thomas, Simone, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right, so what concerned you particularly about this pipeline?
So the idea of the story came when I was in Chicago last year reporting on something else, and I met several young officers who went from Iraq and Afghanistan straight to the Chicago Police Department, all under the age of 30. And I was like, that was interesting. So when I came back to work, I was like, I really want to make this my next project. The problem is, there's no data.
In
every case, an officer who wants to join the police force is given some kind of mental health screening, I would suspect.
Medium to large size departments, yes. My colleague, who we partnered on this investigation, found a report from BJS, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which reported about half of departments, mainly small departments, don't offer any screening at all.
Now, how have you found this to be an actual practical issue on the job, William Thomas?
Well, for me, it was towards the end of my career when I deployed to Iraq. And when I came home, I went back to work. I was there maybe two tours. And my world just kind of fell apart. And I ended up in the VA system off and on for about a year before I actually went back to work to retire.
How would you assess your abilities as an officer, what you need, the tools that you need to do your job prior to deployment and then after deployment?
Well, prior to, I had military training prior to
becoming
a police officer. So that skill set that I learned in the military aided me while I was a police officer in Newark. None of that changed when I came home from Iraq, other than the initial PTSD issues that I began to suffer with.
So, I mean, you understood after your deployment that you were taking PTSD onto the job with you. How challenging was that?
Well, it was difficult. And to credit the Newark Police Department, they allowed me to come back in an administrative role where I did not have to have contact with civilians and citizens and back into that environment of policing. So I was able to finish my career in an administrative role.
But this is a serious issue for an officer who's armed on the streets, would you say?
I would say so, but having PTSD as a police officer, I mean, you can get that from, you know, calls that you may go on. So I don't see that it totally precludes an officer from being able to do their duties.
Do you think there's a support network that needs to be there that, based on your investigation, is sorely needed?
Yeah, so I wanted to take William Thomas's story as an example. The way I met him was through the Newark Police Supervisors Union. And to my understanding, it wasn't an easy path to retirement. From what the union said, they were aware of his issues, and they really had to advocate and push the department to say, hey, take him off the streets, put him on desk duty. It's not an immediate thing. And the police department did acknowledge that to us. And so what I found while reporting the story is while departments weren't necessarily cooperating, unions were. Union presidents in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia were really helpful for this reporting because they actually can pinpoint officers who they're helping who are currently on the job. And what we found, especially in Philly, is they're directing people into a treatment center when there's several of these across the country that specialize in addiction and PTSD issues for those who are combat veterans and police officers.
Simone, we've heard lots of stories in issues of police brutality and police misconduct that there's a militarization of police departments around the country, and that can have a negative effect in communities. Do you think the veteran pipeline is something that exacerbates that, that makes that worse, that suggests that some veterans maybe shouldn't be on the street who are?
So what we found in our reporting, again, there's no data out there. So we, through public records law, tried to get information from 33 police agencies from across the country. Only three gave us enough data to analyze. So the disparities we found were in Miami and in Boston. And we did find that those with veteran status did rack up more use of force complaints.
We want veterans to be employed. But do you think we have a system in place that can deal with the issues and risk factors that are coming back from combat in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Not at all. So when you speak to these police chiefs, most of them are men, and most of them are really macho, and they're like, we don't have a problem. No one's complaining. Well, of course no one's complaining. Like, this is an environment that if you're perceived as weak, you could lose your job. You'll be made fun of. You'll get a crappy shift. But it's really interesting. A female chief, Kathy O'Toole in Seattle, is actually the person who directed me, like, you need to look into these laws. So I found women commanders and the union heads were the ones who were sympathetic to these guys and women, not the actual police chiefs in these big cities.
And of course, you know, the service to the country is a very important factor here. But what is the likelihood, William Thomas, that an individual veteran might be continuing a war on the streets of a city as a police officer without any support because of some of the issues that Simone is talking about?
Well, I would hope that these officers returning from combat zones or actual combat would be getting help through the VA, even if their police department denies them or if they're afraid to report that to their agency, that they would seek treatment through the VA system, which they have access to.
Do you think that's enough?
I believe so.
How about you, Simone?
Not at all. So officers who I met, and William Thomas, again, is a little older, are most 20s, 30s guys who told me in our interviews, which we didn't really use in the story, they're suffering from nightmares or they go home and talk to their wives about their issues. But it's embarrassing to report and say, hey, I have a problem. So I found that most officers who are getting help, it's through the peer-to-peer network. And it's sort of like off-the-books therapy. And if more help is needed, they are plugged into a therapist network of the city.
Possible challenges and risks in the veteran-to-police force pipeline. From Iraq and Afghanistan, Simone Weichselbaum is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. She investigated the veteran-to-cop pipeline over an 11-month period for a report that was published this week. And also with us, William Thomas, longtime member of the Newark, New Jersey Police Force, sergeant retired. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
About 300 million people worldwide are celebrating Nowruz, the traditional Persian festival of New Year and the coming of spring. Sunday is the last day of the nearly two-week festival, with celebrations in the Balkans, the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea regions, and of course, Iran and the millions of Iranians living in exile. Sizda Bidar is what Iranians call this last day of Nowruz, marked by picnics and the strong smells of sprouting crocuses, hyacinths, tulips, and grassy mountainsides painted in flower-petal brilliance before the summer heat dries and dulls the landscape. At least that's how I remember my first Nowruz decades ago as a reporter in Mashhad, Iran, city of gold domes and grand hospitality, even in the middle of the U.S.-Iranian tensions in the 1980s. And those tensions certainly haven't gone anywhere, which is why each year, and this year, Louisa Shafia, a chef, food writer, and author of The New Persian Kitchen, says she hopes the fragrant saffron and the other smells and tastes of the holiday will remind people to rise above national politics and remember that we are all more alike than we are different.
I feel like Nowruz is a really great opportunity for people to see just the beautiful culture of Iran and the nature of Iranians, really. It's about nature, it's about hospitality, it's about family and eating really good food, which of course is a really powerful way to build bridges with people. I mean, it's sort of the way that I have always reached people is just showing them how beautiful and delicious this food is and the ancient traditions that go along with it and everything that the Persian culture is about.
Now, how do you celebrate in Nashville?
This year, actually, I partnered with a local restaurant here called Butcher and Bee, and we did a beautiful Persian Nowruz meal, and it was actually a fundraiser for a local nonprofit here called the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition, who are working to help people in the wake of the recent immigrant ban. So it was a really wonderful way to celebrate with a whole room of people and everyone excited to learn about Persian food and also, you know, help in this cause.
With the travel ban in mind, any young person in your family, have they said anything which takes you aback in terms of, hey, what's going on here?
Well, so my family is here with all different kinds of statuses. I mean, my dad is a naturalized citizen, but I have a lot of family here, and some people are students that are here on student visas. Some people are here with green cards. And then, of course, there's people like me that were born here in the U.S. So we all have different situations, but for sure, people that are here with just a visa have lots of question marks. And, you know, my two cousins that just come to mind right now are both engineers and studying to further their degrees. And, you know, they're people that felt like their skills would be needed here in the U.S. And to be told that there's a good chance that they might get sent back to Iran just for political reasons is, you know, it's really sad and it's been really surprising. I have to say that even people like me with Iranian heritage and that have an Iranian last name or a Muslim last name, things feel different. And I definitely feel, you know, some second thoughts about flying now. And are people like me going to be pulled aside just because our name is a little bit different? There's a lot of uncertainty right now.
Your father is an expat. His lifetime really spans a very troubled history of Iran insofar as its relationship with the United States is concerned. How do you feel right now, or how does he feel?
My dad came here before the Iranian Revolution, and so his perspective is very long and wide. I really only came to consciousness about Iran and politics in 1979 when I was a kid and the revolution happened. And all of a sudden, my dad and mom stopped saying that we were Iranian and Persian. And I remember people asking my dad what his accent was and him trying to play himself off as German, which didn't really work. But I can't help but feel really hopeful for our future. I was very encouraged by the nuclear treaty that went through in this past year, and I felt like that really was a great opening for the U.S. and Iran to move forward. Iranians love Americans. If anyone gets the chance to go over to Iran, they will hug you and tell you how happy they are that you made the trip. And I feel like that spirit has just, it's got to be infectious and it's got to mean something good for our two countries moving forward, because the other option is just, it's just too unfortunate to contemplate.
What are you preparing for Nowruz this year?
Well, I have done a lot of Nowruz cooking already. What I have been making is kuku sabzi, which is a baked egg dish, and it's full of green herbs, fresh green herbs, to symbolize spring and new life, which is what Nowruz is all about. And I like to add ground walnuts and rose petals to really beautiful and fragrant Persian ingredients. Also, I have a recipe for ash-e-reshte, which is really easy to make. You just throw in a bunch of different beans and noodles, and then it gets lots of fresh herbs and even dried herbs. So it's a mix of those two. So in the end, you have this really rich bouquet of herbs, and then it gets topped with caramelized onions. And then also I wanted to share my recipe for sabzi polo, green rice with herbs and with pistachios. And part of Nowruz is that you set out something called a haftsin table, which has 7 foods that begin with S on it, including garlic, vinegar, sumac, all things that begin with S in Farsi. And one thing that you also include on this table is either a book of poetry by Hafez, one of the most celebrated Persian poets who lived in, I want to say, the 13th century in Shiraz.
Great poet.
Or you can put out a copy of the Quran. So it's kind of up to the way that people want to interpret it, but it's really a shared holiday for everybody.
Louisa, thanks so much for sharing them with me.
Thanks, John. Great to talk with you. Nowruz Mubarak.
Thank you so much. Louisa Shafia is a chef, food writer, and author of The New Persian Kitchen. She spoke to us from Nashville, Tennessee.
One of these days you're gonna die, man.
That's right, I have missed Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and all these weeks of me being wherever the heck I was. Rafer Guzman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John, thank you.
It's Friday, talk about movies. Ghost in the Shell, I've seen the trailer about 3 or 4 times. It looks like the $6 million man slash Scarlett Johansson upgrade.
That's right.
What could possibly be wrong with that?
Yeah, well, she plays a major. She's a futuristic cop. She is basically a human brain that has been transplanted into a robot body. She's hunting terrorists in kind of a Tokyo-esque city in the future.
I loved her in Lucy. We'll have to see here.
I have to do a deep dive. I have to get inside her memory. Consent required for data download.
I give my consent.
What'd you think?
Well, I'm going to start with the big controversy over this, which is whether or not this is another case of whitewashing. Ghost in the Shell was originally a manga, an anime film from 1995. And so there's been a lot of talk about whether or not this is a case of a white actress taking what should be an Asian role. I'm going to have to say, yes, it is. The charge sticks here. I don't want to spoil too much about the backstory of the character, but when you see it, it's very clear there's no reason that this couldn't have gone to an Asian actress. And, you know, I guess the other thing I would say is, you know, political incorrectness aside, that's the least of this movie's problems.
Oh, really?
It is just a computer-generated mess. It doesn't, it's cluttered with all kinds of effects. The action is really, I think, very mundane. There's no real soul or anything really interesting in this story. I was never a big fan of the anime. It always just struck me as kind of a Blade Runner ripoff, and this one seems pretty much the same to me.
All right, the movie number two, The Boss Baby, with our good friend Alec Baldwin. Let's hear a clip.
Who are you?
Let's just say I'm the boss.
The boss? You're a baby. You wore a diaper.
You know who else wears diapers? Astronauts and NASCAR drivers, that's who. Called efficiency, Templeton. The average toddler spends, what, 45 hours a year on the potty? I'm the boss. I don't have that kind of spare time.
Is this an Alec Baldwin fantasy movie? Is this something he's always envisioned for himself? How does this work? It's animated, of course.
It's animated, yes. He's playing a little infant. He's the new arrival to a family. That's his brother you hear there, trying to figure out who this demanding, bossy infant is. You know, I think a lot of people were hoping this would be another great case, another great way for Alec Baldwin to do a version of his Donald Trump impersonation and playing the domineering, bullying CEO yet again.
Bruce Willis did something like this a decade ago.
Yeah,
right.
You're thinking of more than that. You're thinking of Look Who's Talking.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
And so it is pretty funny to hear Alec Baldwin's voice coming out of the mouth of a little infant. But I would say this. The Boss Baby was originally a picture book for children. And I think when you stretch that over the course of a 90-minute film, you're really stretching the material way too thin. It just doesn't work. The character, I can't go into the complexities of the story here.
Because there are none.
Well, there are almost too many to even count. But it just doesn't work as a movie. Even though I do think that Alec Baldwin gets some good zingers in here and there.
All right, let's try for movie number three, The Zookeeper's Wife, Jessica Chastain, one of my favorites.
You can never tell who your enemies are or who to trust. Maybe that's why I love animals so much. You look in their eyes and you know exactly what's in their heart.
That's Jessica Chastain playing Antonina Zabinska, who was she helped run a zoo in Poland during World War II that became a hiding place for Jews. True story. The movie's a little too tidy for my taste, a little too glossy, a little Hollywood, but it's a really incredible story and very interesting and important, and I'm glad it's being told.
Same weaknesses as Hacksaw Ridge, just kind of too much.
I'd say it's almost too little. The movie's a little too mild-mannered for its own good, I would say. I wanted a little more drama and a little bit less sort of period costume Hollywood. But it's still a solid film.
Go Gonzaga. Rafer Guzman, you have a great weekend.
All right, you too, John.
Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Takeaway culture reporter Melissa Locker surprised us recently by stepping off her normal, highly wired planet of data networks and Bluetooth speakers, infinite downloads of music and entertainment, and shuffled off to a place full of music and culture, but only primitive cell and Wi-Fi service, Cuba. We were a little worried for a while that Melissa might start to turn blue from lack of cultural oxygen, but not to worry. She took to Cuba's mid to low tech digital scene by seeking out the big DJ himself. The late Fidel Castro made sure Cuba's music scene was part of his revolution, and the musicians of Cuba did the rest.
He would use music to really kind of continue his message of being a revolutionary. He was organizing concerts and he would sponsor artists. And some of the music that they came up with was really good, even if you don't necessarily agree with the message.
Y apretarlas en la mano y seguir andando con ellas por la vida, por la vida.
Por la Vida, that's the name of the song, is very famous in Cuba. It's very different from the mambo tradition which preceded Castro and really just represents the stripped-down, almost folk style that really began the sort of new ethos of Cuba under Fidel.
Right. It was about kind of the message almost as much as about the music. And that slowly started to change a little bit. Like later on after the revolution and kind of post-revolution Cuba, there was something called a Nueva Trova, which was led by Silvio Rodriguez and a guy named Pablo Milanes. And their music was beautiful. It was protest music, but kind of that Cuban protest music where they're protesting kind of the rest of the world. But then also, you know, sometimes pointing out problems within Cuba itself. In about 2008, Pablo Milanes kind of passed the torch to this group called Los Aldeanos, which was one of the first groups to really show the rise of Cuban hip-hop. And if you haven't heard Cuban hip-hop, it's kind of amazing. Yeah. Los años no engañan, el tiempo puede estar bravo, que yo sigo siendo yo, yo a los falsos casos no hago, yo trabajo diariamente, no soy creyente ni vago.
So is this post-Soviet collapse or right at the edge?
Los Aldeanos came out much later, like around 2007, 2008. But the interesting thing about them is that even as far as, like, I think like 2014, the U.S. government was still trying to foment discord in Cuba. And the way they decided to do that in the more modern era was by sort of co-opting hip-hop music. The USAID came in and started working with Los Aldeanos to try and get them to spread seeds of discontent and sort of use their music as a way of uprising against Fidel. So while hip-hop culture was also rising, there was also this kind of music called cubitón, which was a Cuban version of reggaeton, which is reggae-inspired with a really good beat, and it's so much fun to listen to. And one of the few Cuban crossovers is a band called Gente de Zona. Part of their acclaim because Enrique Iglesias featured them on one of their tracks, and it's a track that was played everywhere around the world.
How does this music get shared? I mean, this is all stuff that you found not downloaded, not streamed. This is stuff that you got basically hand-to-hand.
A lot of times there was these, they'd basically hand USB drives back and forth. And they would hand, like, PDFs of magazines, or there'd be mixtapes, or there'd be, you know, DVDs.
A 1956 Chevy plus a DVD drive plus an old floppy disk. I just love Cuba. The story of Huichi de Vedado is really a great story in that it's low-tech, high-tech at the same time.
Right. So Huichi de Vedado is this amazing electronic artist. He's one of the first to really kind of combine Cuban music and Cuban rhythms with electronic music. But when he started, he actually couldn't afford any of the equipment because Cuba's not one of those places where you can just go down and like plunk down your credit card and buy the laptops and synthesizers that you want. So he really had to patchwork everything together to be able to create the music that was really inside of him. And so listening to his music now is so much fun because you get to kind of understand where he started and see where he's going now.
Melissa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Locker is culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and, of course, The Takeaway. Yesterday, Russia's Vladimir Putin went to great effort to once again deny that he has any aggressive designs on manipulating U.S. elections or fomenting tensions with the U.S. and disrupting NATO countries in Europe and beyond. But the circus of revelations continued on Capitol Hill in Washington yesterday as former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn signaled he would tell all in exchange for congressional immunity, while Republican Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee Devin Nunes disclosed that two senior officials at the National Security Council and White House Counsel's Office on National Security Issues both provided Nunes with reports that showed evidence the Trump team was swept up in some alleged Russian surveillance. The Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Burr says he believes Russian meddling round two is about to begin.
We're on the brink of potentially having two European countries where Russia is the disruptor of their leadership. And what we might assess as a very covert effort in 2016 in the United States is a very overt effort as well as covert in Germany and France.
Senator Burr believes that as Britain invoked Article 50 this month, beginning its departure from the European Union, it has thrown the elections in Germany and France and elsewhere wide open. Suddenly, Russia's Putin, who was facing a united U.S.-European front against its aggression in Crimea and Ukraine less than 2 years ago, is now looking at opportunities to exploit new cracks in the European alliance. James Nixey is head of the Russia and Eurasia program at London's famous Chatham House think tank. James, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Is that how you see it? Russia's now out of the woods and publicly ready to manipulate elections in Germany and France?
It's a complex picture. I mean, you're absolutely right. Russia has achieved significant mini victories or substantial victories in the USA with Brexit in the past 12 months or so. And it clearly, if you're a gambler, like Vladimir Putin clearly is, then you throw the dice again, don't you? So elections are always a time of uncertainty, no matter whether you're a democracy or an autocracy. And so if you have a clearly pro-Russian candidate in the form of Marine Le Pen in France, then the Russians are going to go all out as much as is possible without being too overt about it, although a press conference between Le Pen and Putin was pretty overt just last week. And similarly in Germany, whereby Germany is under pressure by Donald Trump to spend 2% of their GDP on defense. They're not going to make it. That is going to put Merkel under pressure. It doesn't mean her victory is assured, which does leave the door open for a more pro-Russian candidate. So there is at the very least all to play for still.
Is it your assessment that Putin cares one way or another whether Britain stays in the EU or not, or does Putin just love instability, whatever complexion it happens to be?
You're quite right. I mean, I think clearly instability is what Russia thrives on. It likes the rotting flesh, if you like. It feasts on it. So there's a certain element there of Schadenfreude, if you like. And so as far as Brexit is concerned and Article 50, then that diminishes the European Union power. And that therefore means in Russia's zero-sum terms, because Russia believes it is a zero-sum game. If we're weaker, they are stronger. We may not believe that, but if they think you're in a zero-sum game, you're in a zero-sum game, by the way. So the point is, it makes Russia's voice louder in Europe. It just eases what they have to do. In terms of getting their goals and ambitions and message across, then there's one less obstacle in the way now.
Is Marine Le Pen's message to the French people something that can be amplified by Vladimir Putin, who can remind Europeans that, he has this energy switch that he can turn on and off in the form of gas and oil to, fuel the European economy?
Well, yes, very much so. And you see, unlike in the USA, where I feel there is no really substantial pro-Russian constituency, that's not true for France. France has always been the odd one out in the European Union. You know, the Gaullist nature has carried on, if you like. They didn't want the UK in the Union. They don't really regard the post-Soviet states as fully independent. So there's a general sort of inclination in France not to understand the Russian line more than there is in, say, the UK, Germany, and the US. So I think that obviously Marine Le Pen has to be careful she doesn't go too far, although some would consider she's gone very far already. She's taken Russian money. She's appeared in a press conference with Vladimir Putin. She spent an hour and a half with them. She backs President Putin even more overtly than Donald Trump did in his election campaign. And as you say, at the same time, they're also more vulnerable, not so much in the energy terms, because of France's reliance on nuclear power means it's more energy independent than many other countries. But there is nonetheless exists a substantial anti-American, far right, far left, because it's the same thing, pro-Russian constituency in France. So she is certainly appealing to a significant, well, we don't know if it's a minority or a majority yet, but she's certainly going all out for a win on that basis.
Isn't it different in Germany that the nationalist voices like Frauke Petri are also anti-Russian traditionally in Germany?
Yes, Germany isn't as susceptible as France in some ways to the pro-Russian line, although, having said that, Germany's attitude towards Russia has traditionally always been very business-driven. For example, there are about 800 German businesses in Russia with investments in Russia. There's only about 200 UK businesses, by contrast. So nonetheless, Angela Merkel has dragged them kicking and screaming along that you need to take a more principled approach if you want Russian money in the longer term. And so that is an important part. But you're right. the former foreign minister, now president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, Ingmar Gabriel, have all expressed surprisingly, shockingly at times, pro-Russian views. Clearly, Germany wishes Nord Stream 2 to continue, which is a pro-Russian, anti-Ukrainian, because it bypasses Ukraine, energy project. So Germany is quite torn, as, to be honest, as so many countries are. It's torn between the those who argue for a principled and morals-based foreign policy and those who say we've got to be real, we've got to get practical, we've got to understand Russia. These are still opposing forces, still battling it out there.
James Nixey is head of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Chatham House think tank in London. Thanks so much, James.
Thank you.
And here's a couple of things to take with you today. One large step for a billionaire named Elon Musk, who conducted a successful satellite launch and recovery of his recyclable SpaceX system. A booster from a Falcon 9 rocket launched for the first time ever was reclaimed on a barge to be used again. One large misstep, on the other hand, for the great American infrastructure that other billionaire in the White House says he wants to fix. A bridge on Interstate 85 outside of Atlanta collapsed last night, creating a state of emergency, a huge fire, gigantic traffic implications, but fortunately, no injuries. Well, we got that going for us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website building platform that helps anyone register a domain and create their own website. More at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move. Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.